It's only a little rattlesnake. It's only a little vaping. Only is still dangerous. Nicotine products can lead to a shortened lifespan. Get help quitting at waittoquit.org.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 14th of April, these are our main stories. Iran has launched waves of drones and missiles towards Israel. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said Israeli armed forces were ready to respond, while President Biden discussed the escalating crisis with his security team. We hear what this means for longtime enemies Israel and Iran and the wider Middle East region. Also in this podcast, police in Australia try to establish the motive for a knife attack at a shopping mall in which six people were killed, but they say they don't think it was terrorism. And a call for more action to be taken to address the glaring gender gap in science. We talked to a female scientist whose male boss won an accolade for her work. Iran has launched a direct attack against Israel, raising fears of an escalation of violence in the Middle East. On Saturday evening, Iran's elite Revolutionary Guards Force said it had launched dozens of drones and missiles against specific targets in Israel. As we record this podcast, they're still to reach their targets as they travel over Jordan and Syria on their way to Israel, where air defences have been prepared to shoot them down. President Biden has cut short a weekend trip to return to the White House for urgent discussions on the escalating crisis. This comes after days of warnings from the US and its allies that Iran was about to attack Israel in response to a deadly airstrike on its consulate in Syria at the start of April, which Tehran had blamed on the Israelis. I spoke to Siavash Mehdi Ardalan from BBC Persian and asked him what more was known about these missiles and drones.
We don't know how many drones exactly. We know they're in the dozens. This was what was stated in the statement that came out from Iran's Revolutionary Guard, IRGC, which was Iran's first confirmation that these attacks took place. And in that statement, it mentioned drones and cruise missiles. And that's when we learned that it wasn't just drones. Another Iranian website that is close to Iran's High National Security Council, which is the highest authority that took this decision, as also was stated in the IRGC statement, that website said that as those drones approach Israeli occupied territory, and by occupied territory, they don't mean 67 territories, they're talking about all of Israel. When they said those drones approach Israel, then the first batch of Iran's ballistic missiles will be fired. And there was confirmation that those ballistic missiles indeed have been fired from Iran towards Israel.
And what do you make of the timing of this? Because Israel has carried out many attacks on Iranian targets in Syria. Why such a strong response from Tehran to this consulate attack, especially when Israel hasn't claimed it as it has other attacks?
Well, you have to look at the background of this. This comes on the back of over 10, 15 years of a war of words, of a covert war, of an indirect war between Iran and Israel. Israel has been constantly hitting at Iranian forces inside Syria and has also carried out a number of covert activities inside Iran, assassinating Iranian scientists, killing Iranian commanders. So I guess the thinking in Iran was that this is not working. You know, at some point, we have to draw the red line. And, you know, attacking the Iranian consulate, as the Iranian supreme leader said, is considered an attack on Iranian soil. So they felt that they had to establish some sort of deterrence. They're obviously expecting a positive outcome for this. Obviously, the calculus is that, you know, as some scholars inside Iran said, the decision that's been taken will completely change the equation, the rules of the game, the rules of engagement that has so far been observed by both sides.
And the big fear for the US and Israel is that this won't just be an attack from Iran, that its proxies and allies could also get involved.
We heard just reports that Lebanese Hezbollah has shot some drones and directed fire into Golan Heights, and that the Houthis, they're still unconfirmed, that the Houthis have also launched some attacks. What the news from that website that I said is close to Iran's High National Security Council said, they said that this is the first phase of a very complicated operation. So by complicated, how long it takes, what it involves, we don't know. It could involve also what another report from Iran said, a hacker group close to the Iranian government said that they have hacked Israeli radar systems.
That suggests there might be possibly a second wave of drone and missile attacks?
Absolutely.
Siavash Mehdi Ardalan from BBC Persian. In an address to the nation, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, had this to say.
Citizens of Israel, in recent years and even more so in recent weeks, Israel has been preparing for the possibility of a direct attack from Iran. Our defense systems are deployed. We are prepared for any scenario, both defensively and offensively. The state of Israel is strong. The IDF is strong. The public is strong. We appreciate the US standing by Israel's side, as well as the support of Great Britain, France, and many other countries. I have set a clear principle. Whoever strikes us first, we will strike them. We will defend ourselves against every threat, and we will do this calmly and with determination. I know that you, citizens of Israel, are also keeping your cool. I urge you to listen to the directives of the Home Front Command. Together we will stand, and with God's help, together we will overcome all our enemies.
The Israeli army spokesperson is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Hagari.
The IDF is fully prepared on all its fronts in defense and offense. The defense and offense systems of the Israeli Air Force are on alert, and dozens of planes are in the skies, prepared and ready. We are conducting a situational assessment with our strategic partners, primarily the US, and maintaining tight coordination with them.
Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Hagari. Yonah Jeremy Bob is senior military correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. He spoke to my colleague Lucrecia Burak about how Israel was preparing to defend itself and what this means for the wider region.
Look, the country is on a war footing. It's been on a war footing since at least Thursday night, Friday morning. But now that drones are actually launched from Iran, dozens of drones, again, until now Iran has always used proxies to attack Hezbollah, militia groups in Syria, militia groups in Iraq. This is the largest attack we're going to have seen so far from Iran.
Yonah, what does war footing mean for Israel practically? What are people doing?
First of all, there are aircraft in the air and are ready to defend and attack. Attack Iran, attack Iran's proxies. So the military is on a huge war footing. The air defense reservists have been called up for over a week. The country has canceled any educational forums for the coming period. Most of those forums were closed anyway for the Passover holiday break, but some were still happening, so anything that was going to happen has been canceled. And they've, you know, reinstituted certain regulations about limited numbers of people that can gather, so there are large groups of people that could be hit. So, you know, everybody in the country, from the military to the civilian population, knows that something unusual is happening.
In terms of the sirens, when was the last time they were heard in Tel Aviv?
My recollection is the last siren heard in Tel Aviv was in January. That was around when Hamas lost the capacity to fire rockets from Gaza that far away.
Once those sirens are heard, Yonah, what happens next?
So there are people who, you know, move into safe rooms even before. There are people who run to the safe rooms. You might have 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, depending on where you live.
Yonah Jeremy Bob from the Jerusalem Post. We've got more on the situation in Jerusalem with our correspondent there, James Landell.
It's quite late here, so the mood is that people are in their homes. There's not a great deal of traffic on the streets. We can see some police cars out and about. We know people have been warned to keep close to their phones, where they can get access to the civil defence apps. There are reports tonight that those civil defense apps are warning residents in Eilat, in the south of Israel, right down at the south, and also those in the north close to the Golan Height, to stay in the vicinity of their shelters. So that is the first indication that we've got of possible areas that may be targeted by some of the Iranian drones that are targeted on Israel tonight. People of Israel have been warned by their leaders to remain calm, to trust the air defense systems that have been able to protect them from these airborne attacks. You know, that is the great test tonight, is to see whether Israel's air defenses will operate as effectively as we are often told they are.
Yes, a big test for Israel. And there's also a big question that many people around the world will be asking: how will Israel respond? Is there going to be the likelihood, if Iranian missiles or drones land on Israeli soil, of an Israeli attack on Iranian soil?
We don't know the answer to that question yet, because we simply don't know what's going to happen in this attack, and what impact it's going to have, how effective it's going to be. If it is a successful attack, if there are substantial successful strikes on Israeli military targets, and if there are civilian deaths, then that will be part of the calibration, the calculation that Israel makes in its response. If actually the air defences work, and if Israel's allies manage to shoot down quite a lot of these drones and possibly missiles, if the attack is able to be nullified, then that then will, I think, temper the scale of Israel's response. But Israel has been very clear that it will respond in kind. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, said, "We will harm whoever harms us." So that is the calculus that is in play tonight as to whether or not what is already a regional war becomes an all-out regional war.
James Landau in Jerusalem. I also spoke to defence and diplomatic analyst Jonathan Marcus and asked him for his thoughts on the situation.
We have to sort of note what a bizarre moment we are in. We have the announcement by a country, Iran, that it has attacked another country, Israel. Israel has said that it has detected some of these weapons heading its way. Some of these weapons could be relatively slow. They could take hours, in fact, to get there. Look, if you were mounting this kind of attack and you really wanted to do serious damage, the likelihood is you would try and swamp the defences, and you would try and swamp Israel's defences, both in terms of the numbers of weapons that are used to attack them, but also the variety of weapons. There are a number of systems that the Iranians have which can reach Israeli targets. They have drones, which are the slowest. They have cruise missiles, which are a bit faster. They have ballistic missiles, which go up out of the atmosphere and down again, which are the fastest of all. And so if the Iranians really are serious about doing damage, then you might expect a coordinated strike by different systems, all planned to try and arrive at roughly the same time, to overwhelm Israel's defences, to give its radars and battle management systems problems in dealing with a host of targets at the same time.
Is this perhaps Iran telegraphing very clearly what it's planning to do? Because it wants to retaliate. It wants to show Israel that it won't just to sit down and take any attack on its consulate, which it regards as its territory. But at the same time, it doesn't want to escalate the conflict in the region.
Well, look, it's certainly escalated. I mean, of course, as we've heard already, the Iranians regard the attack on their consulate in Damascus as being an attack on their sovereign territory. Now, you can argue the legalities of that and the nature of the target, you know, military officers meeting there and so on. But, you know, a direct military attack by one state on the territory of another is an escalation. Iran and Israel have not traded direct blows like this before. So it's a clear escalation. In terms of whether this is them kind of doing something to show willing, as it were, and then it will all subside, well, that's a nice idea. The difficulty is, once you fire live weapons at people, you presumably expect them to hit their targets and do some damage. Remember, not least, these weapons are overflying a large number of other countries where they could land and cause damage and casualties as well. So it's a very, very significant and an unprecedented moment that we have this evening, and we're all obviously waiting nervously to see what actually transpires.
Jonathan Marcus. Well, a short time before the news emerged that Iranian drones were heading towards Israel, the US President Joe Biden cut short a weekend trip to return to the White House for urgent discussions on the situation. He had warned that an Iranian attack on Israel was imminent and had assured Israel that US support for it was ironclad. Natalie Brand is a DC correspondent for our partner network CBS. She was outside the White House and explained what some of the US preparations for this situation look like.
We've learned that the US has been moving additional assets to the region to really bolster the protection of US forces in the region and try to bolster deterrence. We're also hearing from our Margaret Brennan and Pentagon producer Ellie Watson that the U.S. Has fighter jets on standby. Israel, as we know, says that it's been preparing for this attack, for the worst case scenario of what sources told CBS News could be more than 100 drones and ballistic missiles. But at the same time, experts on the region have said that while they believe Iran seeks retaliation, they also believe that Iran does not seek conflict or a situation that would draw in the United States. We know that the U.S. preference here is that the Israeli government wait and assess the impact of what's to come of an attack and then calibrates its response depending on the outcome here. Again, experts I've been talking to on the region, one Iranian expert from the Middle East Institute says that really what remains to be seen is how Israel will respond to an attack by Iran. And he also noted that the Iranian regime just doesn't know whether the Biden administration has the political influence over Prime Minister Netanyahu to determine what his response will be and really prevent further escalation here. There's just so many unknowns at this hour.
Natalie Brand outside the White House. So, is the situation being closely followed by people in the US? Our North America correspondent, Will Vernon, is in Washington.
It's an election year here, isn't it? And that plays into absolutely everything. And relations with Israel, especially, of course, with the war in Gaza, that has become an election issue here. And there are large groups of voters, many traditionally Democrat voters, who are extremely unhappy with President Biden's support for Israel. There are large groups of them, these voters who are minority groups, are young voters, exactly the kind of people that Joe Biden needs if he has any hope whatsoever of remaining in the White House come November in that crucial presidential election. So absolutely is being followed closely here by all the US networks, by ordinary Americans, in the context of that wider issue of the war in Gaza, but also, of course, in terms of the security of America's most important ally in the Middle East.
Will Vernon. Iran has long avoided direct conflict with Israel by operating through proxies and allies like Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen, or Hezbollah in Lebanon. So what does this unprecedented attack mean for the wider region? Here's our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
I think, to be honest, the ball is really in Israel's court now, whether they want to make this into a bigger confrontation, a bigger escalation. All the talk that we're hearing from Israel is exactly that. This is a game, essentially, that's been played by Iran and Israel for years and years. The shadow war, the one that's come up more into the open, Iran has used its proxies in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, time and time again against Israeli-linked targets since October the 7th, against the US targets very often before that, against Saudi targets, against the panoply, essentially, of countries with which Iran has had hostile relations. So this is taking us into uncharted territory. There's no doubt about that. But I think we need to hold back for the moment for several hours to really think about how big and how far this could go as an escalation. I mean, we've heard from the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu for years that he believes that a war against Iran, essentially by Israel, spearheaded by Israel, but backed by the West, by the US in particular, is essential. And that was to do with Iran's development potentially of a nuclear weapon, which Netanyahu sees as an existential threat to Israel. I think if Iran did have a nuclear weapon, obviously, again, we'd be in an even darker, more difficult situation. That isn't the case. So there will be huge efforts by the US, by the international community, to try to bring this down, by the neighbors of Israel and Iran as well, the Arab countries, all of whom have it in their interest for this not to escalate, not to become something which could spark into a regional war.
Sebastian Usher. Still to come, we hear how a boat carrying the bodies of 20 people thought to be migrants from Haiti was found thousands of kilometers away in Brazil's Amazon rainforest.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, turning to other news away from Iran and Israel, Australian police say it's too early to say what the motive was for a stabbing attack that left 6 people dead, most of them women, at a shopping centre in Sydney. But they don't believe it's terror-related. The lone attacker was shot dead by a female officer. The suspect is thought to be a 40-year-old known to the authorities. 8 people are being treated in hospital, including a 9-month-old baby who had emergency surgery. Her mother is believed to be among the dead. Phil Mercer sent this report from Sydney.
Police were called to the Westfield Bondi Junction shopping centre just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon local time after reports of a man with a knife. Shoppers fled in panic or tried to seek shelter inside. This woman was one of them.
And I was hiding in the back room and I was just hearing gunshots. It's just like the worst thing ever. Like, who does that to people?
Teams of police surrounded the building and the attacker was shot dead by a police officer inside the shopping centre. The New South Wales Assistant Police Commissioner Anthony Cook explained what happened.
A single unit officer, Inspector of Police, was nearby, attended, went into the centre, directed by a range of people. She confronted the offender, who had moved by this stage to level 5. As she continued to walk quickly behind him to catch up with him, he turned, faced her, raised a knife. She discharged a firearm and that person is now deceased.
This man was nearby.
Just as we were coming around the corner, there he was. He just came in and just started floating towards us, and all I heard was put it down, and then she shot him. She didn't shoot him. Well, he would have kept going. He was on the rampage. He was on the bloody rampage.
Several people, including a 9-month-old baby, have been taken to hospital. Some are in a critical condition. The New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb later gave an update on the police investigation. She said officers believe they knew the identity of the attacker and thought he was a 40-year-old man.
If in fact it is the person that we believe it is, then we don't have fears for that person holding an ideation. In other words, that it's not a terrorism incident.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, praised the police officer who'd shot dead the knifeman. He described her as a hero and said there was no doubt she'd save lives through her actions. He added that the attack had been beyond words or understanding.
Phil Mercer in Australia. A boat with the bodies of 20 people believed to be migrants from Haiti has been found on a river in Brazil's Amazon rainforest region. With more details, here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
The boat was found on a deserted beach where the river meets the Atlantic Ocean in the northern Brazilian state of Pará, more than 3,000 kilometers away from Haiti. Local media say they were probably sailing at sea and were pushed inland by the strong tides that are common in the region. Thousands of Haitians leave the country every month, trying to escape poverty and lawlessness at home. Many fly to Brazil or neighboring countries, but attempts to reach South America by boat are rare.
Leonardo Rocha. A recent UN report has called for the closing of the gender gap in science. Less than a third of engineering graduates are women, and in physics it's less than a fifth. On top of that, a survey of students here in the UK found female students in science subjects experience far greater levels of sexism than those studying in other areas. However, long-term campaigners say this discrimination is nothing new. They point to the male-dominated management of scientific institutions and the tiny number of top science prizes given to women. One of those most famously overlooked for a Nobel Prize, the most prestigious award in science, is the astronomer Jocelyn Bell Burnell. In 1967, her male boss was given the accolade for her discovery of the pulsar, a new kind of star. She has since become a leading advocate for greater diversity in science. Nuala McGovern met Professor Bell Burnell recently at a literature festival. They discussed that huge discovery and the fallout over the prize.
Along with the data that I'm meant to be gathering, there's just occasionally a little signal that doesn't make sense. Blip, 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 blip. And I could see that the blips were equally spaced. And once that source had passed, it was gone for the day. So then I go to my long-suffering supervisor and says, Tony, that funny signal, it's a string of pulses, 1 1/3 seconds apart. Oh, that settles it. It's interference. We've got this very big radio telescope, very sensitive. In addition to picking up the rather faint cosmic radio signals, it'll pick up anything else that's broadcasting at that wave band. Pirate radio stations, badly suppressed cars, you name it.
But he was wrong.
Ultimately, it turned out he was wrong. First of all, he came and checked that I'd wired everything up correctly, so he stood looking over my shoulder and agreed that, yep, and on the next day it was still beating, same time, same period, same place. So then we quietly ask a colleague and his grad student. That other piece of kit picked it up as well.
Did you feel vindicated?
Very much so, yes, very, very much so. But in a sense it was getting too exciting, too important, because you don't leave that kind of thing to a grad student.
Is it the grad student or is it the female grad student?
I'm sure female was a factor in it, yes, but also grad student.
The Nobel Prize was awarded for the pulsar in the 70s, but it was awarded to Tony Hewish. You know, when I look him up online now, it comes up notable student Jocelyn Bell Burnell. How did you feel when he was awarded that prize?
It's a day I remember very, very well, because by then I was working in X-ray astronomy, which you do with satellites. And our satellite was launching that morning about 8 o'clock. And then at about 5 past midday, a colleague came rushing into my office. Have you heard the news? Have you heard the news? Oh, my God, the satellite's gone in the drink. And it wasn't. It was the announcement of the Nobel Prize for Physics to my thesis advisor, Tony Hewish, and the professor who was head of the department, Martin Ryle.
There was backlash on your behalf because of that. What did you think?
I was very pleased that there was a Nobel Prize at last for something in astronomy. There's no astronomy Nobel Prize. You're going to be part of the physics Nobel Prize if you're there at all. And that year was literally the first year that anything astronomical had been recognised by the Physics Prize Committee.
But weren't you frustrated, angry, upset?
I was proud.
Well, so you should be, because your discovery had been awarded a Nobel Prize, but you hadn't been given the credit.
Yeah, but it was more important that they had recognised astronomy.
After the discovery, you and Tony Hughes were interviewed about the discovery. Well, on the pretext of the discovery, but the questions you were given compared to Tony were very different. He was asked about the discovery, about the pulsar, and you were asked about whether you had a boyfriend or, I don't know, lifestyle questions a woman.
Yeah, certainly the press were interested in my bust, waist and hip measurements and how many boyfriends I had, whereas they talked to Tony about the pulsars.
The astronomer, Professor Jocelyn Bell-Bunnell. Now, let's return to our main story. Iran's launch of an aerial attack on Israel involving drones and missiles. At one stage in the evening, Iranian sources were reported to have said the operation was over. For his final assessment, here's Siavash Mehdi Ardalan from BBC Persian.
This was a breaking news that just came in. Basically, it means Iran is saying that this operation has concluded, that it's no longer firing any drones or missiles towards Israel, even though we still don't have any indication that those cruise missiles have been fired towards Israel. What we have confirmation of is the shooting of several or dozens of drones towards Israel. Now, whether what the Iranian permanent mission to the UN said is really a reflection of what's going on the ground, because it runs contradictory to media reports that we're getting inside Iran from the Revolutionary Guard affiliated news websites that just a few moments ago have said that once the drones approach Israel, the first phase of Iran's complicated operation will begin. So we're not sure whether the operation has concluded, as the Iranian diplomatic mission to the UN has said, or whether this is part of a longer operation that involves not just drones, not just cruise missiles, but also attacks from proxy groups in Houthi in Yemen, which we're getting reports of, and also shots fired from Hezbollah in Lebanon. Significant escalation. But if the matter is concluded as far as Iran is concerned, then obviously now the ball is in Israel's court.
Siavash Mehdi Ardalan from BBC Persian. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
No. Oh my gosh.
That's the sound of Becky getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be getting her sheep a predator-proof pen, and we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on a fuel-efficient Honda, like the 2024 Accord Hybrid. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you, and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.